Okay. We will be continuing our theme of Abraham this morning. But for those who are getting bored with that theme, come back next week and you'll hear about Rosh Hashanah.
That's not even for a lot of all that sense. The real people.
Is that 2 weeks ago? Okay.
Well, it's in 11 days.
It's coming around the corner. It'll be the Shabbat following, that's right. Next Shabbat will be a mystery. But let's start the morning with some prayer. Lord, thanks for the Shabbat, and thank you for being faithful to us. Thank you for bringing us here. And I pray you would send your Spirit on us and speak to us through these words you've given us that have been true long ago and still true today. Help us learn from them. In Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so for the people who haven't been here the last 4 or so weeks, we have been slowly working through Abraham with skipping and jumping and hopping. We've probably done the first 6 verses several times with different focus points. And last week, Brian took us back to chapter 12, specifically to point out that after Abraham had received the blessing and he had started to go through the land, we have this mention that he came to the place of Shechem, which is probably a cultic site, and he builds an altar, and the Lord appears to him. And so so we have been trying to put ourselves in the perspective of Abraham, where he was at this time, instead of reading back through the eyes of history and everything else we know, and our whole theological viewpoint, which may or may not be the same as Abraham's. For instance, Abraham was fully committed to following God, and the way he understood to do that was to go to a place to meet with God. It happened to be a place other people were meeting with other gods, but he was trying to meet with the Lord. And God revealed himself to him. And that's the beautiful thing. 2 weeks ago, we talked about verse 10 and on in chapter 12 of Genesis. And that deals with, you could say, the first written complication in the plot. There may be some between the lines before that. But here we have a famine, and Abraham decides to go down to Egypt. And so in looking at this story, we compared it to the two other stories where the theme is, she is my sister. One other one with Sarah and one with Rebecca. And that helped to shed light on this story. Some of the things that aren't stated explicitly, when you compare to the other stories, kind of pop out at you. And our conclusions were that chapter 12 was more or less the worst case scenario. And by the time you get to there's chapter 12, chapter 20, and chapter 26. By the time you get to chapter 26, God specifically says, don't go down to Egypt. And so we, knowing that, we came back to chapter 12 and we wondered, why did Abraham go to Egypt? I mean, you could say there's a famine in the land, but he had no God directive to go to Egypt. But God did work it for good and brought him back up to the land. So, at the very end, look at verse 20 of chapter 12. Pharaoh commands people, basically to guard him, and escorts him out of the land. He and his wife and all that was with him. A Okay, I made us read that verse today, because today we're going to start in chapter 13. So who would like to read two verses, chapter 13?
First two verses. And Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold.
All right. So, verse 20, we already read that he and his wife and everything with him. So here it's slightly redundant, but now he's repeated it to pop in some new information. And what's the new information?
Lot.
Lot was with him, specifically. In case you were wondering, because the previous story has just been dealing with Abraham and Sarah, his wife.
He was never mentioned in chapter 12.
No, he was in the very beginning. It's mentioned in verse 4.
All right.
Abram went as the Lord commanded, and Lot went with him.
Okay.
And back many weeks ago, we discussed how Lot had joined himself to Abraham's promise. And he was, in a sense, Lot was being obedient to that calling as well, the way we were understanding it. And Brian also pointed out last week that this promise, right before the famine, Abraham has a promise to your seed. The first promise he got was, I'll make you a great nation, but not specifically to your seed. Now we have to your seed in chapter 7, and so Abraham is thinking, well, we discussed what would he be thinking as a 75-year-old with no children. What does it mean to your seed? And so we came to the conclusion it meant to your family. And so who would be a logical person that would refer to? And we came up with Lot. Lot is his closest male relative, you could say. And he's there with him. And so Abraham could very well have understood this blessing at this point in time to be referring to Lot. And so that's why maybe in verse 10 it's less of a shock when we find out he's willing to give up Sarah. Because we also point out how they had a very strong relationship up to this point. And yet here it seems like it's over. He's just willing to let her go.
What? Which verse is that?
Well, the whole story of verse 10 and following. If you tell...
Oh, you're talking about chapter 4. Sorry, Anna was in a muddle. That was in 12.
It's all in chapter 12, yeah. The first she's my sister's story. He tells his wife, say you're my sister, so Pharaoh takes her as a wife.
Okay.
So there's no promise he's getting her back.
Oh, wow.
So he's saying, he's willing to let her go at that point. And so it's significant then in chapter 13 that Lot is mentioned again. So Lot had been with them. And he did not give up. Lot stayed with Abraham the whole time. So you could see maybe from Abraham's perspective, if he believes God's promise is coming from Lot, he didn't necessarily know that Sarah had to be involved. And so for him, it was a decision of survival for himself and for those with him. And so so there's Lot, and they're still together.
At the expense of Sarah.
At the expense of Sarah, right. And of course, we don't know, you know, it doesn't tell us how everybody feels about the situation. Because we only...
Could you please explain what the situation is?
You need to have a Bible open in front of you, and you need to read it.
Okay.
Chapter 12 of Genesis.
Yes, ma'am.
Because we're going back and kind of mentioning things from last week and the week before. And if we take too much time to go back and redo everything, we won't do anything new today.
Okay. I'll learn it by next.
So... But basically, Pharaoh takes Sarah as a wife, and then Abraham gets him back. Because God makes everybody in Egypt infertile, and so Pharaoh realizes she must be someone else's wife.
Oh. Wow.
Okay. So verse 2 of chapter 13, Genesis 12, sorry, Genesis 13, verse 2. It says, Abraham was very heavy with cattle, silver, and gold. So we know he got some blessing up above from Egypt because of what happened with Sarah.
The heavy is the Hebrew for wealth, is it here? What is it, kaved?
Kaved. Here it's an idiom for wealth. It's not always an idiom for wealth. And in fact, it's a rare idiom for wealth.
Rich.
Kaved, to be heavy.
Rich in Arabic.
Okay, no, I mean you can... This is a metaphor. To be heavy, very heavy in cattle. How do you translate that? You can say to be rich in cattle.
Loaded.
Very rich.
Loaded. There you go. That's a great idiom. Because
I'm a farmer.
It works in English. To be loaded means you have money. Oh. You have wealth.
Because the other one yeah, is in verse 10 of chapter 12.
Yeah, the famine was also heavy. And that is typical. Famines are usually kaved. They're usually heavy, severe.
What's the link? I'm sorry to be pedantic or ignorant. What's the link then between kaved and kavod, which is more to do with honor, but it's also to do with weight?
Well, in English we have the same connection. If something is weighty, it could be serious.
Awesome.
It could... You can have both ways.
Profound.
Something that's due kind of respect. It's a weighty issue. And we also have...
Yeah, okay. You said it.
They're related. They're related words. They come from the same root. They're right. Different words, but related. So right. Certainly in stories you can play.
Right. And in terms of God, you talk about the
His honor.
His honor. His kavod. Yeah, right. Which is to do with the weight of his... amazingness or awesomeness or
right.
Okay, thanks.
And God plays with that idiom quite a bit in Exodus. Because nikhbad, to be honored, he even uses it like I will be heavy. He uses it kind of playing with the meaning both ways. To say I will be honored but hinting at the other meaning as well.
And yet Moses' lips.
It's all over. Genesis, the first 20 chapters, you can follow the line of heavy and honor, and it's amazing, it just keeps playing with
it. And it's also true then here, as regards Abraham, he is heavy with cattle, he's wealthy with his cattle, but that's part of the honor of the man, that he is wealthy in cattle.
Right.
I mean, he is honored by his
They have
his
been
wealth.
Connected throughout yeah. society. Yeah.
It's the same way.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he left the land when the famine was heavy, and he returns from Egypt
heavy.
With heavy stuff back to the land.
Right. And so you have kind of good brought out of a bad situation. So verse 3, he goes about on his journey from the south, from the Negev, and up to Beit El. Up to the place that his tent was there in the beginning, between Beit El and Ai. And verse 4, until the place of the altar that he had made there in the beginning, and he called there on the name of the Lord. And that's interesting too, because we talked about with Brian, you know, the first thing he does, basically, he follows the advice to leave his homeland, come to the land of Canaan, and then what? So he goes up and he builds an altar, and God appears to him. So after this whole ordeal with Egypt, that certainly taxed everybody's faith, he's kind of coming back again. So he's coming back to the same place, and to me that's saying he wants to hear another word. Like, now what? What was that all about, or what should I be doing?
It's interesting that when you go back to Shechem, where he first built the altar, he went to this place in between Beit El. It's a second, right?
Sorry. Right, well, but it does say to the place of the altar.
Right.
He did build several altars,
well,
yeah.
Verse 12 verse 7, he built an altar in the vicinity of Shechem. And then it says in verse 8, he went to where he's going now, and he built an altar there.
Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. I'm not sure where Ai is now.
What's interesting here, though, in 7 it says he built an altar to the Lord. But at Bethel, it says, is there he called upon the name of the Lord. Is there a difference in that?
Yeah.
Well, in the first place, God appeared to him. Right.
So in the first place, the altar could be more of a memorial altar. Like, God appears to you, so you document it, in a sense.
And then Bethel is later where Jacob comes, so Bethel has a vision. So that obviously is like a high place.
But we'd also talk about, you could see kind of a progression in, you know, he's coming from a polytheistic world. So there, in his worldview, there are many gods. And yet he's trying to be faithful to one God. But does that necessarily mean that he knows that there's only one God? No. And so you might be seeing a progression as well. He's getting to know God more and more. He's calling on the name of the Lord in verse 8.
I always get stuck on that.
Uh-huh.
Calling on the name of Yahweh, and yet it says in Exodus 6 very clearly that you never knew my name. Only now do you know my name.
Right.
And before you just knew me as El Shaddai.
Right.
So, but wasn't he talking to Moses though?
He was talking to Moses. That's right. So Moses is the first one to know. I mean, my understanding always is a bit that Moses wrote it anyway. Wrote Genesis anyway. So for him to call on the name of the Lord is to call on El Shaddai.
It never actually says that Moses wrote Genesis.
No, I'm saying that's the only way I've understood it.
Why?
Well, that's the tradition.
No, I'm saying, but who knows? Maybe if Moses didn't write Genesis, then maybe the problem is less.
All right.
Right.
But I thought in Exodus 6 it says he's talking to Moses personally. Moses grew up in Egypt, Pharaoh, of Egypt. He's not growing up among the Israelites. And even they are probably not very faithful in worshiping the Lord.
Right.
It says, God also said to Moses, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, Yahweh, the Lord, I did not make myself fully known to them. Exodus 6:3.
Well, I think there could have been some forgetting between Abraham and his descendants.
This is fully known.
Does say fully known.
Well, the name, the tetragrammaton name, has been revealed Exodus 3.
I mean, I think the whole issue of Moses and the calling of Moses and Moses being given his name for the first time is really important. I mean, he was calling on God Almighty.
Uh-huh.
He was calling on this one true God who he'd heard and he'd seen.
Right. We also talked about the...
You said 6:20?
No, 6:3. When the person writing the story is writing to us, he lets us know he's calling on the Lord Almighty. But does that mean that Abraham's words were that? See what I'm saying? From our perspective, we know God and we know his name.
Right.
And so that's who Abraham was calling on.
Right.
Does that mean Abraham knew God in his name?
I think
I don't know. But Abraham knew who he was calling on.
That's right. That's it. Yeah.
So
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be interrupted.
That's good. For the record it says, Ushmi Adonai lo nodati lahem. So his name Adonai, your translation says I wasn't fully known. You could play with that as well if you want to play with it. We'll go back to Genesis 13. So he's kind of come one full circle, coming back to God. And then we'll continue in verse 5. Let's see, maybe someone can read 5 to 7.
Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. And the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land.
Okay, so these two verses are interesting to me because well, two reasons. First, it sounds like this sounds like a nice way of telling the story. Does anyone else get that impression?
Yeah.
The land couldn't hold them both, but it can hold.
Not big enough for the two of us.
It can hold all kinds of their descendants, you know, but it can't hold these two people. So it seems like between the line there is a family fight. There's something.
Ariv.
There's Ariv. It says that. You mentioned that. There's Ariv.
Yeah,
it puts it between his workers, his shepherds, who actually deal with the flock and stuff. But it might be more than that, as we'll see in Abraham's words in verse 8. So hold that. Like, this seems to be kind of covering over a bigger issue that we don't know what it is. But it also, we have this statement again that the Canaanite and the Perizzi were then in the land. And we had talked earlier, in chapter 12, we were given that same information. And anytime you're given that, the narrator is injecting it for you right at a specific point. And so the question is, why? What are we supposed to understand from that? And our previous discussion remained slightly ambiguous in the end. Because was it to tell you that there were other people in the land when Abraham came? Or was it to point out specifically that they were Canaanite and they were, worshiping foreign gods in contrast to Abraham? So both things could very well be an option there.
Or that they were also in the land and everybody was squabbling over which,
right,
which hill they should have or whatever.
So in this case, maybe that's more the intent, that there were other people in the land, specifically the Canaanites and what your Bibles might say, Perizzites. I don't know. Perizzite sounds too close to parasite. Perizzi. So, Abraham, let's go to verse 8. Abraham says to Lot, "Don't let there be an argument between me and you." That was a hint I was referring to. Because so far the narrator mentioned it's between the shepherds, but Abraham makes it between me and you, Lot. And between my shepherds and your shepherds. Because we are brother people. What is your...
Close relatives.
Close relatives.
We're blood.
That's good. Ki anashim achim anachnu. We are from the same people. And let's put this in perspective of what we were talking about in chapter 12, where Abraham is seeing his promise connected to Lot. And so this is also a serious threat. In the same way the famine had been a threat, they went to Egypt, and they had this whole, you could say, trauma. This could also be traumatic. Because the very person who's supposed to inherit your blessing doesn't seem to be getting along with you. What are you going to do about that? I mean,
You have family issues.
I mean, I think everybody can relate.
We all can relate, don't worry.
Because all of us have some kind of family issue somewhere.
I wonder if this is seen as yet another failure, though, on part of Abraham, that it comes to not being able to resolve it and him saying we just have to part ways.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense of failure.
It makes me think of the prodigal son parable, where he's like, I want to take my inheritance and go. Because, yeah. Well, how does Lot have enough shepherds to be even to compare to Abraham? That's what I understand.
Right.
It seems...
Because...
He's starting to change on something that
Abram certainly is bigger. He's heavy in cattle. Cattle includes sheep and goats and cows and silver and gold.
So maybe he gave him half of what he had.
Maybe. Right. For Lot, we only know that he had cattle and sheep.
Would Lot have had stuff from his father that he would inherit when he came also?
Yeah, maybe.
Well, presumably, if he was going to inherit Abraham, he would have inherited all his silver and gold and everything Abraham has as well. But is this parting kind of a legal thing? Is he forfeiting some of his inheritance by leaving? So whatever this is serious enough that to preserve some semblance of peace, Abraham asks him to leave.
And all so the shepherds are just fighting it out, and Lot's guys are just jealous of the other guys who apparently got it better.
It could be.
I don't know.
But whatever the issue is, it's serious enough that in Abram's eyes, the only way to deal with it is to send Lot away.
Well, is he sending him away? Or is he simply saying, this is ridiculous, you can go to either the right or go to the left, whichever you do, I'll do the opposite. I mean, it's not really sending him this way. It's basically saying, this is ludicrous. Let's just split. You go north and I go south. Or you go east and I go west.
Let's just split.
That's the same as sending him away.
Oh, is
sending
it?
Away. No, you're right. He's very nice and cordial about it. But I'll just read what you were saying in chapter 9. He said, isn't the whole land in front of you? So I think if Abraham speaking this to Lot also sounds like he's saying, he's reminding them, you're part of this promise. The whole land is in front of you.
And also, it says in verse 6, Lo yachnu lashevet yachdav.
They weren't able to dwell together.
Together. Does that make you think of the song, Inema tov umanayim shevetachim bayachdav yachdav?
How great and how pleasant it is when brethren
sit together in one place.
That's a British understatement for leave before we kill each
other. But it's that same word of shevet. So, dwelling together, they're not able to do it here.
And he specifically, I was using words in verse 9, he says, separate, please, from me. Hiparedna me'alai. So he's asking him to leave. He's saying, please leave me.
I think the acquiring of the wealth from Egypt might signal the problem here, because before going to Egypt, there was nothing like he was heavy in wealth and all whatnot.
Well, we know he was still something, but not as much.
But giving out Sarah might have been the opening of door for the wealth to come in, and not only to acquire the silver and gold, they could also male servants and female servants that were given to him because he was so generous to the whole Pharaoh of Egypt by giving his sister, as he claimed.
So you're saying the wealth has complicated his life. That's true. It usually does. It usually does. And so he says, if you go left, and actually if you remember in the Bible world, what direction do we face?
East.
East. So left is?
South. North.
North.
If you speak Arabic, you know that already. Left is north, right is south.
South.
And we have countries such as Tayman, speak Hebrew, Yemen, Yamin, it's right.
Right equals south or right equals east?
Right equals south.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. You're facing east. You're oriented in English. It means you are facing east.
The North Yemen country,
Somali. Yeah. Left. Left is north, right is south.
And the enemy comes down from the north.
Yeah. So if you go north, I'll go south. If you go south, I'll go north. Interesting, because he doesn't really mention east and west, but we know it's a skinny little land, and you're traveling on the ridge, mainly. So that all makes a lot of sense. So then in verse 10, Lot lifts up his eyes. You always know when someone lifts up their eyes, they're about to see something. So here we go. And he sees. What does he see?
The whole plain of Jordan.
See, the whole Kikar HaYarden, that whole plateau around the Jordan.
He says, look north and look south, and Lot looks east.
Oh. No, this is an issue to ask, because it also says later that he leaves to the east.
It's true. He looks around. He's not looking north and south. He's looking east.
Mm-hmm.
Looking to the best.
So he sees this Jordan Valley, and it's all watered, lush and watered. So I ask myself also, like, we don't have any time reference here. We don't know. Presumably, time has gone by in Egypt, enough time to discover that Pharaoh's whole house was infertile, and to travel there and to come back. So is there still a famine in the land? Is the famine over now? And what happened to this beautiful, lush valley during the famine? Because it's still clearly very green. So I don't know if it was in the consideration before as part of the land. But we'll get to that in a second. Anyway, certainly when Lot's looking at it, it's lush and green. And so the narrator tells us, by the way, this was before God's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And in that time, it was like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt.
Before climate change.
Yeah. Right, as you come to Tzoar. And I smile when I say like the land of Egypt, because for us today, you know, what do you think of when you think of Egypt?
Sand.
I think of gray, dust, no water. But in Abraham's day, Egypt was a place. Because you have the Nile River, you have gardens, you have green. There's something dependable. Where in this land, you're dependent on rain. If you have no rain, it's over. Egypt has the Nile. So here, you know, like quite, Egypt...
There is quite a lot of evidence, isn't there, that the Jordan...
Was greener,
yeah, and the whole Jordan sure. Valley and the thickets of Jericho and so on. I mean, but maybe it is. It's basically it's at the bottom of the ridge. It's. I mean, we're talking all the time about Shechem and Beth El and Ai and even Gilgal, which is not yet up, but it's on the way up.
Yeah.
So what's going on down there? If we've got famine up here, you've got to make a decision. Are you going to go down to the Jordan where it's kaka kaka, or are you going to go where it's really rich, down in Egypt?
Yeah.
But he's basically going for what he sees as the best part.
Yeah.
Actually, when he looked, he saw Jericho and the vicinity. Mm-hmm. While we knew that he settled in... Sodom, which is south of the Dead Sea,
right.
Very long. I believe that this division took place when Abraham moved to Beersheba and Hebron and that area. Because how come Abraham settled in Hebron and Lot settled in Sodom?
But here, the last geographical reference we have, he's back up in between Beit El and Ai. And so according to the text, that's where this discussion is happening.
The discussion, but
yeah, so
actual separation was when they moved south.
That's interesting. So in verse 11, Lot chooses the Jordan Valley, and he travels Mikedem. Yes, that's interesting. He travels to the east. He's also going to the south, but he travels eastward. And I guess maybe that's how you'd have to get down into the valley.
Maybe that's another sign of how much they trust each other at this point.
Right. If you go south, I'll go north. If you go north, I'll go south. He's like, fine.
I'll go east.
I'll go east and then get down.
Both of these options are crappy.
Yeah.
I'll go east where it's okay.
And so, each man separated from his brother. So that's our summary statement. So there is this division. In verse 12, we have a contrast now. Abraham dwelled in Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the Jordan, Valley, the Kikar. And he pitched his tents near Sodom. Ad Sodom. So he's not, according to here, he's not right in the city yet.
Yes, I am.
So that's interesting to me, back to our discussion, what is considered Canaan. It appears from this verse that the area of Jordan is not Canaan.
Right.
Because they're being contrasted. And how does this then relate to Abraham's great promise of this land is going to be yours? Lot is the natural inheritor.
He's gone.
And now here he's gone, and he's basically left the land.
Yeah.
And so how does Abraham feel at this point?
Well, you can read the last sentence there.
Okay. So the people of Sodom are bad and sinners before God.
Very.
Very big sinners before God.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, so he's left, in a sense, it's like, it's a big disappointment. Really, any way you look at it, the best case scenario looks like a disappointment. But if Abraham's thinking that he has his whole promise through Lot, and now he couldn't agree over something, and he's given Lot, even though Abraham's the older one, he said, Lot, you decide where you want to go. I'll go the opposite way. And Lot goes off and chooses something that wasn't even part of the options, and now seems to not even be part of this promise.
So in fact, he's losing his inheritance.
Yeah.
I mean, well, go back to
it. I think he took it with him.
He took what he would have.
He took whatever was available at the moment.
Yeah, but in terms of the land, I'm talking about the land.
It sounds
a bit like your prodigal son again.
Yeah.
Yes,
it just goes off
like
where it looks better and, you know, greener and richer and wealthier and whatever.
Yeah.
And he ends up in the pigsty, just like these guys end up.
Kind of like, I want it now. And I see where it's good. Sounds like what?
Esau.
Esau?
I was thinking of Mashiach, Hakshav, Shalom, Hakshav. We always want it now.
Possibly, yeah. Fitting right now.
And Sharon, that may be part of the problem with the breakup is Lot may have got impatient about being named the inheritor.
Maybe there were issues of hierarchy, issues of rank between him and his shepherds,
and
that was repeatedly making problems.
God just won't die.
It's amazing when you do think about these things slowly and put realism into it. It's a whole lot more complicated and real than first appears. And for that reason, it's comforting to the rest of us who are also complicated and real. Anyway, all this to say, I think that's why verse 14 is here. Read verse 14. And God said to Abraham, after he separated from Lot, after Lot separated from him, lift up your eyes and see from the place that you are there. Look north, south, east, and west. All the land that you see, I will give you and to your descendants until forever. And I will make your seed like the sand, and if someone can count the sand, they'll be able to count to your descendants.
So in fact, he's telling him that he's going to get the east and the west as well. I'm sitting on the ridge in Canaan.
Right.
That's the promise. You were to go down into Canaan.
Right.
And then basically, I'll tell you what the next step is. And this is step two.
There's always been a bit of ambiguity, because the first command was, go to land, I'll show you. And it didn't say Canaan.
Right.
But the response was, so he got up and went to Canaan. So
right.
Somewhere there seemed to have been a directive that Canaan was that land.
Right.
Yeah. But here, you know, now Lot's left Canaan proper.
Right.
And we get this kind of an expansive thing. Look south, north, and east and west, like it's all still, or maybe even an addition. now that Lot went outside, maybe that's going to be yours too. I mean, there's room to read both ways here, I think. But if you see it in the context of the fight that's just happened and the disappointment, this God comes and reminds him when he's down and wondering how this whole promise is ever going to work. And he gives him that reminder, look, I'm still giving this all to you. This is going to happen. And so Abram gets another chance to believe when everything looks like it's to the opposite.
So tell Danny that the Dead Sea is still part of the Promised Land.
Yeah, here,
Dead Sea, either it already was a part, and we just didn't realize it, but that doesn't make sense with verse 12. Or it's just been added. It's just been seconded to.
Right.
Which seems a more probable reading. It just got annexed. And that's also interesting to me, too, because as I see these biblical characters acting in faith, and then they have lapses of faith, the whole time it seems like God is working with them. They make decisions, and there's something within God's promise that wants to be limited to those people's decisions, wants to work with people. And so it's not just this divine mandate all the time. There's a give and a take. And I think that's very applicable.
That's what occurred to me too, because you think that he gives up his authority. He basically forfeits his authority with Lot.
Yeah.
And then yet at the end the response is, okay, well here's more.
Yeah.
And then what's the
thing? So you can see the humility of Abraham to forfeit.
Yeah, what I remember when I was doing the Bible study a few weeks ago, there was this general picture of the heart of this man, Abraham, always being able to respond to worship when God appears and then moves on to the next thing. And it's a sort of continual process, but God is always wanting the heart of this man to listen, to come back, to worship, to build an altar, whatever.
Right.
There's always has to be we have to respond. It's not like he's some sort of deus ex machina that suddenly says, oh, you've got to do this now.
Right, exactly.
Sharon, maybe it's what you're talking about. Maybe it's the response of God as he sees us respond, the light turning on in us.
Yeah.
That we understand what he's saying.
Yeah.
And then we respond as he would have us to respond. And that's pleasing to him.
Yeah.
One thing your father once told me, this is my husband that really stuck with me, is he thinks that God appreciates our struggle. Whereas, you know, we struggle.
Clearly, because he leaves us there.
Sometimes we get very distressed that we are in a place of struggle, but God appreciates our struggle.
I'm sure that's right.
Like the cocoon, you know, trying to get out of the cocoon and press the struggle.
So it's interesting, though, then in verse 17, part of this whole blessing and your descendants are going to be innumerable is get up and walk around the land to her length and her breadth, because to you I'm going to give it.
I know that Abraham gave the first choice to Lot.
Right.
While he is the elder.
Right.
This is another point.
And so he's very humble in doing that. And I think that shows his character, even in the midst of a conflict with Lot, that he's still very respectful, more than he could be properly. Like he could have exerted authority and he didn't.
And again, also like the prodigal son, this is God's. This is what God has given you. This is what God has called you to do. And you know your son is about to go take your inheritance and go spend it on prostitutes and whatever. And same thing with Abraham, with Lot. Lot, you know, is the wayward person here. God promised it to you and you're letting him choose which way. What if Lot says, all right, I'm taking the choicest land here. You know,
right. And if he knows, will he know that the people there are sinful?
Yeah.
That's not going to be a good influence.
Anyone would say that that is irresponsible, You're playing with the lives of the people that you're responsible for.
Right.
What if he takes the ridge that's
what kind of leadership is that?
And you end up in some valley where you're going to get your people get slaughtered because of the pleasing and the kind that are
right.
You know.
Well, when we look at that, I think we will have a lot to say about Abraham. Mm-hmm. Even beginning with the way he gave out his wife, was that a practice at that time? Mm-hmm. He knew that this is his wife.
Right.
But he said, she's my sister.
Yeah.
And this is another man taking her to
Sharon's Bible study on.
Yeah.
He
is no, sister, but it's true, like this yes. willingness to forfeit.
Yeah. Yes.
Just about anything.
Well, he used her to make money. This is clear.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's that movie called? I don't watch movies like that.
So, but back to verse 17. He just been told to get up and walk around the land. This is Abram, right? Every time God says, you know, get yourself going, lech lecha. What does he do? He gets up and goes. Now God says, get up and walk around the land all over it because I'm going to give it to you. What does he do in verse 18?
Because he lives in heaven.
He sets up his tent.
At Mamre.
And he comes and he sits in alone Mamre.
We said it was quite a long way.
And he had built there an altar to God.
Yeah, but he had to go all the way down from it. You know, I wouldn't fancy walking from Bethel to Mamre.
Yeah.
We walked around as far as he was going.
Yeah, well, it doesn't say that he walked anywhere. I mean, okay, so maybe he moved a little bit. He moved back to Ebonet Mamre, but it's like so far everywhere he's already been. It's like a super conservative little path he's taking. And how are we supposed to understand that there, right at the end of that blessing?
I mean, it's such a big one.
Yeah. When God just told you get up and walk around, you're basically go explore. This is going to be your new birthday present.
So Abraham, yeah.
And so Abraham
went as far as his tent pegs would take him.
Yeah. And then
maybe as far as his energy will take him.
Exactly.
So is there still a sense of a little bit of defeat or disappointment here?
Well, yeah, Lot's gone.
Lot's gone.
That's the sad thing.
But God has just shown up because of that, right?
No, but still, it's sad when
right.
a family member, there's a broken relationship.
It is.
I mean, no matter what.
Yeah.
And he's half as imposing towards other people when he does start wandering around. So maybe he feels not as powerful in the face of other people when he shows up on another hilltop.
Right, he has lost some of his own camp.
Yeah.
He's become a smaller entity.
It makes me wonder too that lift your eyes, I don't know what it is in Hebrew, but he says lift your eyes and look, but it also could be lift your eyes because his eyes were downcast. He was depressed. He was in no mood. You know, he was downcast.
Well, it could be. We have the same thing earlier with Lot lifted up his eyes. It's kind of like a longer, fancier way of saying looking.
But it's a commandment. God commanded.
God commanded
that's
him, yes.
That's what she's saying.
Yeah, you're right. God said, hey, look around you.
Yeah.
So you could say he wasn't looking around him at that point.
And I mean, if you think of oneself, you don't think of yourself as being depressed, but every so often the Lord suddenly says, listen, open your eyes and just have a look on really what's going on.
Right.
You know, you're so caught up in your own source, whatever that is, whether it's family or money or housing or studies or whatever, you lose sight of who God is, what he's doing, what's happening in the world. I mean, it could be anything.
The sunset.
Yeah.
It is funny that God, after every single thing like that God says to do, it's almost like very opposite expectation of what you expect happens. Like, you know, go north or south, he goes east, walk around the land, he puts up his tent, and then, you know, he puts up his tent, and then he builds an altar to God, and then the beginning of chapter 4, and he is attacked by enemies. Like,
right.
He just built an altar to God. Why are you letting God, why are you letting me get attacked? Like,
Well, there were enemies attacking.
That's the next question I was going to ask. It looks to me, is he actually being attacked, or is this whole war going on much more down near Sodom?
Lot gets attacked, and so he's
actually out of it. He's not.
He's safe. He's fine. He didn't have to go home.
That's right.
Why did he go home?
My mistake.
Yeah, I don't think he is attacked. I think, you know.
And I think he, even after all of this, we don't have time to really get into chapter 14, but he's still.
He loves him.
He's still in the mindset of he's not giving up on Lot.
Yeah.
Because still, from his perspective, Lot's part of the promise, and he might be the promise, so I better protect him.
Can I ask a terribly naive question?
Sure.
I have no idea what happens to Lot.
I mean,
he rescues him. His wife gets turned to salt. I know all that.
They go off in the mountains, and he becomes the father of Moab and Ammon.
Oh, not so good. Right. Thank you.
And his life drunk.
I always thought of Abraham's, you know, seeming not really cooperating, doing exactly what God said. Practicality sinking in. He'd been kind of wandering here there for some 10 years, and he might have, just being practical, you know, he's 80 something years old now, you know, plant myself here, wherever here happens to be, and then wander around from. That's the way I thought of it. He was thinking something practical, you know, because a lot of times we get direction from God, and then we kind of process it into reality. Like, how can I really do this? Can I really just continue to wander around or whatever?
Or is it okay? A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
It showed at this point he would have needed water, so perhaps he made a bear.
But the thing is, all of these, that's always true. And that was true when he left his home and came to Canaan. So you still are left with the questions, because the way the story is being told is forcing you to ask these questions.
Well, I believe, you know, when we started studying Abraham, we looked at various aspects of his life. Right. But there is something in my mind, you know, that which is more important than all those stories. Where since he was promised to be a blessing, the blessing, we know it's Jesus. We didn't talk anything about Jesus, you know. We missed reading chapter 22, the story of Isaac, especially at the first two, three verses, when the Lord told him to take your son, your unique or only. This is contradict with the fact that at that time he was about 120 years of age, right? Abraham. He had Ishmael. But now he is God calling him, take your only son, which is Isaac.
Well, it's a midrash. And Isaac, your son, which is, and he says, which one? I have two.
Yes.
He says, your only son, I have two. And then he says, the one you love. And
the one,
then,
not
and then
only the one you love.
Love them both. And he says, Isaac.
Isaac, you know, it's Wahida. And, you know, it's a type of Christ, you know, because even Isaac acted something like what Jesus did. He carried the wood on his back when he saw the place from afar.
Genesis 22, you can talk about those parallels. And it's true, you can see type of Christ everywhere, but that doesn't negate the basic initial meaning either.
You know, we see
God spoke to Abraham. He was a man in history, and he said, I'm going to bless you and your
descendants. Actually, the whole Genesis book is history, but in this history it is a prophecy. This is what will happen at the end times, you know. every story about, you know, the story of the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, it's all prophetic.
Most prophecy is relevant to the person hearing it.
The whole book is a prophetic book.
Now, see, Nadine, I just wanted to read one thing, which is in Hebrews, because I think you're right, but at the same time, we learn from the history. And then it says, by faith Abraham, when he got called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going. By faith he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise, for he was looking forward to a city without foundations, etc. So much of Genesis is looking forward, and we know, because we're here, we know that the sacrifice of Isaac is a picture of what God would finally do with Jesus. We know about what Abraham meant.
I don't agree that we are here. No. You know, many churches, especially in the States, I am aware, you know, I read, I hear, they interpret the return of the Jews to Palestine is a fulfillment of prophecy. I never agree with that idea, because how can God fulfill the promise once they are not in belief? You know, in Old Testament, there were small sins that God expelled the whole Israelites to Babylon and somewhere else. How come the sin of rejecting his son, how come he fulfilled a promise?
How can he fulfill his promise to any one of us with our sins?
When we live in faith. You know.
It's grace.
Yes. It's grace, not only
grace. So we're going to wrap up the discussion at this point.
Keeping the law of God, you know, because they didn't keep the Sabbath.